Very good. I think everyone's in now. So, during the talks which I've been giving the last few days, the first days quite deliberately was teaching people how to relax more and not to expect so much. And yesterday, because when I make promises, I really try hard to keep them, to went into a bit more theory. But it doesn't matter about all the theories which we have about the Dhamma, about the teachings, about the truth, the nature of being. It's, we can argue at length and we can discuss, and good people may see different ideas. But the whole point of it is to empower a person to be able to see these things for themselves. And we have something in meditation which we call the five precepts. So the five hindrances, sorry, not the precepts, the hindrances. And those hindrances, when you just go through them very briefly, I'll go through them in detail later on, that it is wanting is number one, the kama chanda. And for those of you who are Pali scholars, that first hindrance is represented in the Satipatthana Sutta as loke abhijja, which is translated rather meaninglessly for most people as covetousness for the world. That's an old translation, over 100 years old, but it's stuck. It doesn't mean that at all. It means the first hindrance of wanting. And that's consistent throughout the whole of the suttas and also through the commentaries. And the second hindrance is like ill will, aversion, pushing away. And I gave an example of that yesterday, which is why I wanted to talk about this first of all, is because that once one has wanting and also aversion, ill will, you'll find that that is what mostly distorts reality. We literally see what we want to see. And we can't see what is just too difficult for us to own up to. And it stops you seeing things as they truly are. Those first two. And it's from those first two that we also get the next two of the hindrances. I'm doing this quite briefly because I want to go to the nuts and bolts of meditation, but this gives you an idea of the overview. And once you have ill will and wanting, that really tires you out. Wanting and aversion is where you do things from, where you struggle, where you strive, and you can see that is work. That expends energy. And you've only got a certain amount of energy. And what happens if you really want something, you want to get rid of something, sometimes you work so hard, it really drains your energies. And that is resulting in sloth and torpor. You don't have enough oomph in your life or in your meditation. And you find that people who do have goals in life, is a Tibetan monk, Chogyam Trungpa. He was a bit of a scallywag in many areas, but he did say some very wise things. This is one of the reasons why you don't just reject everybody's, a person's whole teachings because, you know, in one or two ways they've been a really bit off. Every person, every now and again, has a really good teaching. And you take the good teachings together, forget about the person who said them, because the teachings are independent of that. And so this fellow, he was the one who introduced a very brilliant concept of spiritual materialism. Just like in the world, we want to get on in the world. We want to sort of, you know, get enough money to actually to be comfortable and put a bit aside for when we retire, so we don't have to worry about paying our bills. Yeah, we can live simply or whatever, but as long as we're comfortable. And sometimes people want to be more than comfortable. And so sometimes that is called the materialism of the world. Getting nice clothes, nice cars. But it's also the spiritual materialism which you see. It's how many retreats have you done? Only three. I've done five. retreats. How many jhanas have you got? Only two? Oh, I got two the first retreat. I'm on number eight now. If you don't know this word yet, I should have introduced it earlier. People who come on my retreat often know the word gomayang. Actually, I did say it the first night. Gomayang. Go is the Pali word for a bull. B-U-L-L. And mayang is what comes out of the backside of a bull. So when I say it's a load of gomayang, you know what it really means. I'm saying it's bullshit. But I'm not really supposed to say that word. So now I've only said it once, and now it'll be gomayang. And so it's, you know, people who really think that, you know, spiritual materialism, it just replaces the other materialism of life. And of course there's a great disconnect there. It's not about how much you achieve. It's how much you can let go of. And that was a regular teaching of Ajahn Chah. Heard it so many times that, you know, he just drummed it into us. You meditate not to attain things. You meditate to let go of things. Not to attain things, but to let go of things. So if you're trying to get sowan, which is the Sri Lankan word for being a stream winner, forget it, that's not the path. You're going to get frustrated, wanting. If you're trying to get your jhanas, or at least an impetus, at least watch the breath, at least for a second, please, then that is spiritual materialism again. It's wanting. And you find you can sort of manufacture them, but it's not the real deal. You get stuck. And so, it's meditating not to attain things, but let go of things. It's not spiritual materialism. It's not about wanting stuff. Because wanting has no end to it. You always want something more. I often see people say, oh, all I want in life, I just don't want my kid to be well. And that's all I want. Yeah. When the kid gets well, I want him to be better. And then I want the other, my wife, to be better. I want more money. I want this. I want. Wanting has no end to it. Goes round and round. It's called the fuel which keeps samsara rolling around. And sometimes I look at this world and how much more do we need? We need more, want more, always want more. So when can there be an end of that? So that's the first hindrance. And of course it's together with the second hindrance because you get frustrated sometimes. I see other people work really hard and they manage to sort of get rich. But not me. And I look at poor old Ajahn Brahm. I've been working so hard all my life. And, you know, I'm 67 now. It's time I retired. I can't retire. I've got no superannuation, no savings, no pension. Even my house is a tiny house and I don't even own it. It's owned by the Buddhist Society of West Australia. I've got nothing. All this work and nothing to show for it. Yeah. You're letting go. And of course that's really good fun, just going off on the funny stories. Because every now and again, that, you know, you have to sort of, I have got a seniors card, Australian Commonwealth seniors card. And I don't know why I bother to try and get it, because I don't get anything from it. I'm not allowed a pension. I don't know, what it means. I just, you know, because I'm a senior. I say, where else going? I'm But getting that was incredibly difficult. Because I needed to prove I exist. And straight away when they asked me, I need proof you exist. Look, madam, I've been trying to find that for the last 45 years or something. See, that's what we mean. No, you've got a driving license. No, I haven't got a driving license. He said, well, have you got a marriage certificate? No. Have you got your bank account? No. Credit card? No. What else did he say? Oh, yeah, your rental agreement for... Oh, do you own your own house? He said, no, I don't even rent either. And you went through all these little things you have to tick, you know, to actually to prove you exist, you know, in the social services. And what I always suspected, ever since I started to become a Buddhist, she said, well, you don't exist. Hey, I agree. Well, that's not good enough. So you managed to find a form here and some little thing I had there. Frequent flyer card for Singapore Airlines, that helped. That's one thing. Passports. I did have my birth certificate, but it had a different name in it because I wasn't Ajahn Brahm when I was born. But anyway, they've managed to find it out. And even once I remember just going into Melbourne Airport and I already had the ticket, but they said, we need photo ID, sir. And I said, they put it under Ajahn Brahm. My passport name is Bhikkhu Brahmawangsa. So they put my ticket under Ajahn Brahm. He said, well, you know, you can't use your passport because that says Bhikkhu Brahmawangsa. I said, look at their passport, look at me, it's me. I said, no. So you know what? Just really fortunate I had a copy of Opening the Door of Your Heart in my bag. And I've got a picture of me in the back. See, Ajahn Brahm, me. I said, okay. Let me on the floor. So writing books sometimes is helpful. Anyway, just going back to try to prove who you are, because you don't have anything, because we're not into attaining things. And because we don't attain things, although other people like to. Now, one of the worst things, which, you know, being a spiritual, I call it spiritual snob. Because when I went to visit my mother, you know, that she had my university certificates. And she had the master's certificate. And I said, oh, we don't need this. And I tore it up and threw it in the bin. Because I'm a monk, you know, you don't need this anymore. You know, it's just status in the world. And my mother never said anything. She looked at it. I just put it in the bin. I was renouncing. And then I went off to do something, go to the toilet. When I came back, she had all the bits laid on the table and she was very carefully trying to paste them all together. I felt so awful, so low. Because, you know, it didn't matter to me, but to my mother that was just so valuable and precious. And I felt so terrible for doing a stupid thing like that. That was spiritual snobbery. Yeah, I don't need my certificates. But somebody else did. And you know, my mother did. So anyway, that when we have spiritual materialism and or spiritual snobbery, that sometimes that we just create so much work for ourselves. We want things. We want more. Or we're just averse to things. And that just sucks up a huge amount of energy. That is one of the reasons why we get tired. If we're not tired, it's actually doing stuff. The restlessness. Sometimes if you're restless when you're meditating, why? What do you want? What do you want to think about? All your thoughts and fantasies. I guarantee none of them will work out. All your fears and anxiety of what might go wrong. I guarantee what will actually happen is not that at all. It'll be usually something much worse. And sometimes, if you write sort of what I expect is going to happen in the next 12 months, you write it down. And 12 months ago, just see how many of those things you worried about, you planned about, you sort of wasted so much time on, how many of those things actually happened? When you actually look at it, very few happened at all. And so you think, what a waste of time all that worrying was. It's more than a waste of time, though. It drains your energy. Restlessness makes you tired. You burn up too much energy. Now, I mentioned briefly about sloth and torpor, about the tiredness. It was because you were staying in a climate, malnourished, not sleeping enough. That's one of the reasons why I experienced sloth and torpor, and all the fighting in the world didn't help. Because what occurs, I know, if I really want to, I've got strong willpower. But it's just counterproductive. You don't develop that. But anyway, what I did do was, in the early years as a monk, I would fight the sloth and torpor. Do battle with it. And so all those little tricks, you know, one of the tricks, people, I don't know why they like seeing this, but I haven't got one here, so this is like a matchbox. The matchbox trick. So because sometimes, you know, you're meditating and you think, you know, oh, I'm not sleepy. Because when you're asleep, you don't know you're asleep. So I used to put a matchbox on my head. Now, just with the cover off, just the tray, full of matches. Because every time I would start to nod, it would fall off and make a noise. So that was actually giving me some feedback. I was sleepy. So after a while, I was just really mindful of my head. So I thought, so, you know, it wouldn't be sleepy, it wouldn't start falling. And after a couple of weeks, I'd achieved my goal. That matchbox didn't fall off at all. I told my friends, yeah, this is a great way, this is how you overcome sloth and torpor. And they sort of came and said, Ajahn Brahm, you haven't overcome sloth and torpor at all. You're still going to sleep during your meditation. Only that when you are nodding a different way. You're nodding like this. And that was true. And my crazy mind, it would just trick me every time. So after a while, you know, just sheer force. I'm going to keep my back straight and my head straight. I'm not going to move at all. Really get your willpower going. You know, that was really, really unpleasant all that time. And then you broke, very often you didn't break through at all, but sometimes you broke through. And sleepiness disappeared. And it was replaced with restlessness. My mind was all over the place. I said, oh, calm down, calm down, calm down. As soon as I calmed down my restlessness. And even there was one monk, I'm not going to tell his name because he's very well known. He's not here. But he was, he told me, you know, they would do a 2-hour meditation session every morning before arms round. And again, in the hot jungles. And so he would, and every time it was just such a pain just trying to keep his head up. But one day, just 2 hours, oh, here we go again. He decided, okay, I'm going to have a sexual fantasy. So he was, when he started meditating, he started thinking about girls, romance, whatever, nice fantasy, which he was in control, where the girl never argued. That's why we have fantasies, because it never goes wrong. We could always change it at our will. And he said, it's amazing. He never got sleepy at all. He was perfectly straight all those 2 hours. And it just flew. You know, sometimes when you're suffering, you're tired or restless and you're trying to fight something, it takes forever. This time, straight back and time flew, just 2 hours was, and mindful all the time, sort of. And then afterwards, he finished, he said, wow, this is really easy. But then his teacher came up and he thought, uh-oh. And now some of these monks, they do read rides. And he looked at this monk and he thought, oh God, what's he going to say? In public, all the other monks around, what's he going to say? And he looked at him and he said, you have just been wasting your time. And I thought, that was just so beautiful. It wasn't just, you know, criticizing him or embarrassing him. Just telling him, you just wasted your time doing things like that. And that's a beautiful answer. But anyway, so that put this monk in his place. But anyway, that when we are doing the meditation, sometimes you go back to cause and effect. Why are you sleepy? And of course it could be because you're tired, you need a break. It could be you didn't sleep well at night. It could be that you've heard Ajahn Brahm tell these stories before. And if you haven't heard Ajahn Brahm tell these stories before, you know the story of Albert Einstein? Albert Einstein, you know, he was European. And so when he started to get famous, he received an invitation to actually to tour the best universities on the East Coast. And, you know, he accepted, you know, it was Harvard and Princeton and all Yale, all those places. And so the universities and the club together bought him not the airfare, because there was the boat on the passenger liners in those days. Now, all they'd ever seen of him was just, you know, these grainy photographs on the newspapers. It's not like they'd seen him on CBS News or on YouTube or anything, because they weren't so sure what he looked like. That's an important point. So when he arrived, I think in New York, they'd arranged a chauffeur and a car to take him wherever he wanted to go for the next, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. So he arrived with his chauffeur in the first university. They greeted him, gave him a dinner. He gave his talk, brilliant talk, asked a few questions, went to his hotel the next day, go to the next university. The same car, the same chauffeur. After about 6 or 7 lectures, all the same lecture, the chauffeur, driving him to another university, just happened to say, "You know, Professor, I've listened to your talk 6 or 7 times now. I reckon I could give it myself." And the helper said, "Yeah, why not? Give it a try." He's a bit playful, Albert Einstein. So, they swapped seats. Albert Einstein put on the chauffeur's cap, and the chauffeur sat in the back and got a pipe out to look like a professor. And when they got to the university, you know, they opened the back door, "Welcome, Professor, we've heard so much about you." And the chauffeur, you know, played up to the accolades. He really enjoyed it. The real Albert Einstein had to go and have, you know, something with a servant somewhere, whereas the chauffeur was treated to the best port or sherry in a 3-course meal, and giving all this praise by these great professors at the university. And then the time for his talk, his lecture, on theoretical physics, on some of the deeper aspects of general relativity. And so the chauffeur got up there and just repeated what he'd heard 6 or 7 times already. He had a good memory. He didn't understand a word of what he was saying, but, you know, he just said it. And then, after they finished his lecture, standing ovation. Brilliant. It's just so amazed to see you, Professor Einstein. We thought you were a bit sort of more European and a bit sort of older, but well done. But of course, there was one of the professors in the audience was a bit suspicious. "Is this really Albert Einstein?" So he put up his hand and said, "Can I ask a question of the chauffeur, okay?" Dressed up as Albert Einstein. And he asked this really deep question. I mean, it would really even make Stephen Hawking think 3 times if he was still alive. Really, no, very powerful question. And the chauffeur listened to it and said, "Professor," you know, to the questioner, he said, "That is such a basic question. It may feel difficult to you, but, you know, it's such a basic question. Even my chauffeur at the back can answer that one." And the chauffeur did. So, because I'm very busy these days and getting old, if any of you want to go to give a talk, say you're Ajahn Brahm, you could give a talk. You know all the stories and all the jokes. Just put a pillow under your... So anyway, he repeats his stories, I repeat my stories. Anyway, back to where were we? Oh yeah, with the restlessness and sloth and torpor. So the restlessness, I realized that just forcing it never works. If I try to break through sloth and torpor, then I was restless. Calm restlessness, I was asleep again. It was like two ends of a pendulum. The ball lived on either end. It couldn't find that middle. You're either restless or sleepy. As soon as I overcome sleepiness, restless again. Calm down, restlessness, falling asleep. It took such a long time to understand why. After a while, you know, you give up. Marvelous words, give up. Nothing works, so you just forget about it, give up. So I just gave up. And what I have noticed, when I stop struggling and striving, the mindfulness got a little bit more. Sleepiness started to lift. It was the simile of the mist in the early morning. When the sun comes out, it's still misty. The sun comes out, it burns off the mist, and slowly the mist dissolves, it evaporates, and then you can see, and it's a beautiful, clear day. That's what's happening in sloth and torpor. If I fought it, I just prolong it, or go off into restlessness. So just let it be, and saw it disappear. I was patient enough to allow it to vanish. And when it did vanish, it wasn't restless anymore, there was this beautiful peace, this wonderful equilibrium there. And of course, then you start to go back, why? What's going on here? And the law, the Dhamma, the physics is that those two parts of your human mind, the doing and the knowing. Okay, I mean, it's not an accurate description of parts of the mind, but it's useful for understanding what I mean. You're either doing something, active, reacting, thinking, planning, anxious, whatever, arguing. You're either doing something in your mind, or you're just passive and just knowing. That's really what should be mindfulness, is just passively knowing. A lot of times we react to it. And those two parts of the mind, the first person who gets onto the table to eat the food is doing. That takes up the first share of your energy. And in fact, it takes up most of your energy. And your knowing takes up the remainder, the dregs, the leftovers, which sometimes aren't very much. So that's why you're very, very active. But your knower is starved of energy. Which is why we do have low mindfulness. And if you really fight a lot, you've hardly got any mindfulness left at all. And that is standard depression. Food, it doesn't taste nice. Look at the beautiful flowers. Ugh. Look at the bird flying through the tree, pooping everywhere. And just anything. Ugh. Your favorite food. Ugh. Nothing tastes nice. Ugh. Even the bright colors are grey. Music. Ugh. Heard that before. Great jokes by Ajahn Brahm, heard that before. Nothing sort of encourages or inspires you. And it's not life, it's fault, it's because we're so dull. It's not your fault, it's just your senses are just so low. Everything is grey. And that's because we do so much. And sometimes, and just knowing how the mind works, if you are depressed, just let it be depressed. Milk it for everything it's got. You don't have to go to work. You can lay in bed all day. You know, people are nice to you. In other words, I mean, it's only exaggeration, but if you're tired, enjoy it. Which means you're not fighting it. Which means you're being with it. Because if it's not something, some meaning to it, we tend to sort of want to change it. So leave it alone, and the mist lifts by itself. And you get alive. And you don't, that's actually how you overcome this sloth and torpor, through stillness, non-reacting. And you don't stop there, you just carry on just doing nothing. And then what happens is the energy gets more than ever before. Because you're not doing anything, the energy starts to flow into knowing, more knowing. It's the power of mindfulness, and the superpower of mindfulness, and the mega power of mindfulness, and the incredible, immense power of mindfulness. And that is not a joke, that is actually what happens. You find if you follow the instructions here, which is actually basically doing very little, you start to wake up. That's what it feels like. You know the word Buddha? It comes from the verb bujati, to wake up. When they say the awakened one, that according to the etymology, that's pretty accurate. Awakened one. What happens when you're awake? You know when you sleep, Yeah, this must be my holiday, and I'm getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning in this place. What did I sign up for this for? But when you wake up, when you've got lots of energy, they said, 4 o'clock, yay! Zippity-doo-dah, wonderful day at Jhana Grove. Oh, this is so wonderful being here, full of energy. Don't do that, otherwise you'll get kicked out of your cottage. Everyone else will complain. But sometimes that's what it feels like, yay, full of energy. The natural energy of just the mindfulness getting stronger and stronger. And you just dance through the day. The food, the baked beans, wow, that is vintage. Vintage Heinz baked beans. The toast, oh, it is so crunchy. Just whatever. But you actually feel and you can hear and everything. It's just really amazing. That's a sign you've really got powerful mindfulness. Where does it come from? You've put energy into your body and mind. And of course, the one which I haven't talked about yet, the hindrance of doubt, which is one of the hardest ones to really describe and understand. Who is saying the right things as a teacher? Is Vipassana really the way? Has Ajahn Brahm got it wrong? It's all meditation the wrong way. We should be praying to Jesus. What should we do? So, the simile was, when I was a student, I liked solitudes. I went walking in the mountains of Scotland, right way up in the north. And in the summertime, the northwest highlands of Scotland are just some of the most beautiful parts of the world. It's delightful. And not many people go up there. And so I was up there and just staying in a youth hostel, and I talked to the youth hostel manager or whatever, warden I think they used to call him. And he said, do you want to go for a walk up the mountain today? I said, yeah, that'd be a good idea. It's a beautiful day. So we walked, leisurely, not sort of trying to conquer a mountain. Just go up there, have a nice walk, talk about stuff. And we got to the mountain, beautiful views, over the ocean and over the many other. There's another mountain not far away. So let's go up that one too. Still early. And he said, no, one mountain is enough for me. So he went back to the hostel. And I carried on alone. Which, of course, was really a stupid idea. If anything happens to you when you're alone, you're dead. No GPS, no mobile phones. People start looking for you, but they never find you in those places. But anyway, it's safe enough. I was fit. I knew the area reasonably well. A wonderful day. And so I walked to the other mountain, not that far, about an hour's walk, about 40 minutes. I saw the clouds coming in from the Irish Sea or the Atlantic. And I couldn't believe how fast they came. It was a beautiful, clear day. The next moment, they were covering. And then they came down and they enveloped me in this really thick mist. It was so dense I couldn't see the hand in front of me. I was in mist and I thought, it's easy, you've got a sense of direction. So I just turned around and went back the way I came, so I thought. But I realized totally lost when. And it was a scary, but no exaggeration, because I couldn't see that far ahead of me. I was looking at the ground, and suddenly there was no ground there. One more step, and this was this vertical cliff, which went a long way down. And I looked in the maps, there was only one place on that mountain where there was such a cliff. And it was in completely opposite direction that I thought I was going. You don't have a sense of direction at night time in the mist. And that scared me, because I knew that there had been people that mist can last for days, weeks even, and I could wander around getting nowhere, tired, exposed, not dehydrated obviously, there's plenty of water around in Scotland, but lost, maybe stumble, break a leg, and they wouldn't find me for days. So I stopped and considered my options. Had no idea which way I was going, totally lost, in a dangerous environment. I remember just cause and effect, logic, science. There's one law of science which I could rely upon, the law of gravity. Water always flows downhill. So, a simple answer, I just found a little stream and decided whichever way that stream meanders, I'm going to follow it. And of course, it joined another little stream and another little stream. It got bigger and bigger as it went further downhill. It wound this way, that way. I didn't know which way it was going, except I knew it was going downhill. That's the way I wanted to go. And little by little, I followed it until I came under the mist. Whenever you see clouds on the hills or mountains, they're only on the top of the mountains. When you go down further, you go under the mist. When I went under the mist, I could see everything. I could see my way. Now, it was a long detour I'd made, but still, now I could see, I could find my way home. And I use that experience as a simile for doubt, spiritual doubt, meditation doubt. Are you doing the right thing? Are you going the right way? Is this the right religion for you? Is it the right type of religion for you? Is it the right type of teaching for you? Is it the right place for you? So many questions, but one thing you should know, if it is a legitimate path, it leads in the correct direction to peace, health, to joy, kindness. You can add many, many other sort of qualities there, but you know that, you know, if you're easy to get on with, if people find you kind and peaceful and you can cope with tightness and tension and stress in this world, and you're getting more and more tolerant to others, less greed, hatred and delusion, you must be going in the right path. If you're getting more peace, more happiness, it's the right direction. So to me, that was going downhill, following the stream. And then if you understand that, you can understand just after the day, am I more peaceful today? Am I more relaxed, more wise, more kind? If you are, you've been going in the right direction. Carry on. And little by little, over the days, the weeks, the years, there comes that time when you do go under the mist. You can see everything now. And that's the simile for stream winning, so on. Now you can understand, see the whole thing, how it all goes together. But for the time being, you're in the mist. You follow what creates peace and happiness and joy. Sometimes people tell me that when their partner goes home after a retreat, they were a pain in the ass. They said they were worse when they come back than when they left. Of course, that's not one of my retreats. There's something really terribly wrong there. Or, you know, people get stressed and tired and sick and pain and injured. There's something wrong there. That's not going in the right direction. So you can actually use that as to overcoming the doubt and these hindrances. So anyway, those are the hindrances. Let's actually stop you being peaceful. Stop you being content, always wanting something more. Always getting angry and ill-will and tired and restless and not knowing what life is all about. Doubt. But then, to be able to subdue those hindrances, to calm them down to the point where they are so weak, they're not really active anymore. So that means that you can see things as they truly are. The hindrances, that's why they're called hindrances. They stop you seeing things. So what we do, we just use all these skillful means to calm down our wanting. You don't have that much choice on the buffet tables. You can't just see the menu and just go to another restaurant. There's no other restaurant around. Oh, actually, there is one close by. If you don't like the food here, there's always Bodhinyana Monastery. Sometimes people do that, you know. They look at, actually, the Bodhinyana monastery first, because we serve the food earlier. You go there, have a look. Well, actually, you can see the food, what's coming today. Have a quick look in the kitchen. It doesn't look nice. So you walk over to Bodhinyana monastery. And if you know the right days, you know that people come regularly, you know, the right day to go over there. But there's not much, no, choice you can have here. So it's taken away so you don't want anything. You know, it's a waste of time wanting things. That's what I had a precept for, you know, that we don't sort of do that much. So that we really are subduing our wants, you know, for 9 days. And because of that, you subdue the, you know, the ill will and the anger. You just, what are you getting angry for? It just spoils the whole retreat. So these things are being subdued. You're not planning very much. You're not going to have to just work out your strategies for the next week to make sure that your sales have gone up and that you're pleasing your boss. You don't have to rush through the traffic and take your kids to the doctors and worry about so many different things. The amount of work you do here is just really reduced. Which means that your energy level should be rising, rising, rising. You don't have to do that much. If you look at, compare how much you have to do here and how much you have to do when you're at work or at home, here is just very little. So I know it will happen for most of you. Your mind starts to get empowered again. I usually give it a couple of days. When it does start to get in, wow, this is really happening. You are mindful. Once you are mindful, then that's the time that the worst of the hindrances have been overcome. That's the time that it gets easy to meditate. You notice I haven't really talked much about meditation yet. If you say, when are you going to talk about meditation, Ajahn Brahm? When you're ready. But I thought we'd just come here and meditate straight away. Yeah, sure. Because you just got to get into the place and get your energy levels up first of all. Now your energy levels are getting up there. The next thing, you can sit down. You don't have to sit on a floor, sit on a cushion, sit in your room, wherever it is. And if it's in the morning, if you're too cold in here, now your rooms have got heaters. You can actually sit in your room and get it just exactly the nice right temperature for you. And you don't have to worry that those people who, you know, always have to urinate a lot, you can get, you know, one of these little boxes or something and put it underneath here so you don't have to move. No one sees you. It's nice and easy. Sometimes there's many things we're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to, you know, sometimes you're giving a talk, I have to wait until we start meditating, because everyone's got their eyes closed before I just... It feels really good, doesn't it? You know, just because it really itches, really getting at you, and just, you can actually now do it, no one's watching. So you can do that in your room any old time. I'm saying that because sometimes, because of what's expected of us, etiquette, it can be just so painful sometimes trying to keep etiquette. But anyway, so in the end, we just can meditate anywhere. And then we start to get some mindfulness. We're not forcing it anymore. It's actually interesting. And to start that mindfulness, it's classical. Start with mindfulness on your body. How do you feel right now? Not how you should feel, but how you do feel in your body. Are you relaxed? Or are you tense? Where are you tense? You really get to start to know your body. When you get to know your body, it's amazing what you can start to do with it. Sometimes even my knee's a bit tight now. And so what I would do, especially if you weren't here, I'd just focus on that knee. Be totally mindful of it. So zoom in on it, like on Google Maps. You zoom in and everything on the outside goes away. You just zoom in and see, you've got your knee. And then once you're aware of that knee and the ache in it, then you can start to, you don't even need to do anything or touch it. You just look at it and learn how to relax it. Relax it this way, relax it that way. The classical story, which explains the sort of thing which I mean, was a monk over in Bodhidharma Monastery, was always having a lot of pain when he meditated. And so he found out it wasn't his posture, it was his back. He went to the doctor gave him a CT scan, and reported to him that he has a congenital defect in his spine. Now, it cannot be fixed, surgery won't help. Maybe painkillers might, but there's terrible painkillers with bad side effects. The advice of the doctor was just to stop meditating. But I'm a monk. So that's what I love, that's what I'm here for. He said, well, you're going to have a lot of pain, nothing we can do about it. And so it wasn't a very good sort of a response from the doctor. So then he started looking at alternative ways. And one thing he found was a little treatment where it said that, yeah, you may have a weakness in the spine, but there are muscles on either side of the spine which, you know, you haven't really developed at all. You don't even know they're there because you don't have to. So exercise number one, this book told him, take your hand and stroke either side of the spine, showed exactly where those muscles are, stroke it 15 minutes either side every day. You have to, you know, keep doing it. So he just stroked those muscles until he began to be able to feel those muscles. He was creating the neural connection. Because every time he mindfully felt those muscles as he touched them, you know, the neural connection in his brain to those muscles was being reinforced until he could actually feel them, just like I can feel my nose now, itchy. I can feel my feet. I've got awareness of those because I have to, but there's many parts of the body you just haven't connected with yet because you don't need to. Once he could actually feel the muscles on either side of his spine, the next thing was a trial and error. See if you can move them. But how? No one can tell you. Just try this, try that. And because he was always mindful of those muscles, something moved. You know, because he did that. And he made the connection. He learned in the same way that a child learns how to walk. They fall over many times. A bit of trial and error until the successful whatever you did will move that muscle, reinforce it, until he could start to move those muscles at will. Up and down, up and down, up and down. And then the other side, up and down, up and down. Because he'd developed that ability. And then he had to exercise them every day. And so now those muscles are so strong, way stronger than my similar muscles, that they fully compensate for the weakness in his spine. Problem solved. But the main part of that was learning how you do parts of your body we're just not aware of because we don't have to. And you can really mess around with those. You can expand things, contract things, warm things. So the mindfulness, when you focus on a part of the body, say my knee, focus on it, I can feel it. What do I need to do to create some heat there? Try this, try that, try something else, until you can find it, warmth coming up. This is how people learn, how to move it, how to relax it. So through the mindfulness, you're getting much deeper connected to your own body. That is really interesting, because it's amazing the sort of stuff that you can do. So, some of the stuff which I have to tell the food poisoning story, because this was one of the most dramatic. A couple of years ago now, I think it was. You know the way we eat, as monks, as nuns? And it happens sometimes, we eat something we shouldn't. People are very kind, but sometimes it's some herb or something we're allergic to, or maybe they've cooked the thing overnight and now there's some bacteria in it. Every now and again, people get food poisoning. And I had my food poisoning a couple of years ago. We call it, what do we call it? Occupational hazard. So, food poisoning, I was in my cave. Afterwards, I realized that something was, you know, not right. So I went in my cave and didn't realize how bad it was. Because when you get real food poisoning, you get these contractions. Ah! Ah! And this is a wonderful story to tell, you know, when it's maybe a late night talk and people are starting to go to sleep. Ah! It wakes people up. And sometimes talks can be so, ah, boring when you add some drama in your, ah, talks. People really wake up and it's memorable. But it's also, it's not just for fun, it was actually something real there. You know, it's a long way, you know, to the nearest hospital. And also that, you know, you've got to get out of your cave, you've got to crawl down and people ask you, well, you know, what's wrong with you? Ah! You say, yeah, but what's wrong? Ah! So it's a waste of time. There's other ways to deal with this. And so that's what I did. I just, exactly what I told you then, focused on the feelings of pain and contractions. Really unendurable. Just when it contracts, it's just automatic. And felt it. And then what happened was, you learn how to, because you know your body, just how to release some of the tension, to relax it, just slightly. And so the contraction, the pain, was slightly less. Carry on, you're going in the right direction. Relax it a little bit more. I call it relaxing. What do I mean by that? Letting go. What do I mean by that? Because, you know, what makes the pain less? And the pain was less, 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 less. I forget whether it was 20 or 40 minutes. I sometimes get that confused, but I think it was 20. Not that much longer. And then no more contractions, no more pain. The stomach was totally normal. That's all it took. And that really, you know, shocked me as well. Wow, it's amazing what you can do. It never came back. And I sometimes wondered, you know, as a scientist, what was going on there? There's bacteria in there. I mean, real bacteria. What had happened to them? And so I imagined it. But all these bacteria are like little blobs with all these tentacles on them. That's not how I imagined bacteria from school. Probably totally different. They're just all wobbling around. And I imagine all these bacteria, instead of wobbling around with all the little tentacles on them, had every tentacle crossed in full lotus. And all my bacteria were now all meditating peacefully instead of causing, you know, a riot in my intestines. I thought that was really a cool image. I don't know if it's true or not, but oh, why not? But anyway, they're certainly peaceful. So this, and some of, and what is that, I think 20% or is it 30% of women will have breast cancer? You've gone quiet now, haven't you? This is serious stuff. When you feel your body, that sometimes you may have already had the breast cancer. Sometimes you can feel it in your body. The subject's not quite right. Imbalanced. You can feel that. If you feel it with your mindfulness, not with fear, but you can be aware that something is a little slightly out of kilter, then you learn how to relax everything. You can actually feel just like good energy coming up. I've taught that for so many years, and I'm pretty sort of confident that many breast cancers haven't actually come up. They've been stopped before because they feel them and heal your own little body here. You feel it, relax it, and the problem dissipates. When I was, last little story, Korea some years ago, going on BBC, I think they called it, Buddhist Broadcasting Service, one of Gaksan's one, and just had a cold in the morning. It's cold, there's snot dribbling down your face. You couldn't stop it. It was getting worse. And half an hour I had to be on the TV, live. And so what the heck am I going to do? Didn't have any medication. And if you actually start sniveling while you're on live TV. That doesn't impress many people. So instead, just come on, Ajahn Brahm, do your meditation. So felt just the irritation in your nose and just all this stuff. Don't try and stop it. Just let it be and relax it. And you've felt the irritation get slightly less. You know, the flow of the yucky liquid getting less. Little by little, you relax it, relax it, relax it, relax it, relax it, relax it. After half an hour, it stopped. I just gave my talk on TV as if you never had any cold at all. That is not that difficult for you to do. Once you're mindful, I want you to learn about your body and learn how to relax it. It's mindfulness and kindness, otherwise called letting go, opening the door of your heart to this feeling, relaxing it. So often, what you can do is amazing. And aches, pains, colds. Again, one of the best stories, last little story. Dimi has this on her computer in town. This wonderful letter I got. A lady in Poland. It was Poland, somewhere in East Europe. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Never met you, but thank you. I had arthritis. Really severe. Had to have very heavy painkillers just to get through the day, just to survive. And they had terrible side effects, as strong painkillers do. So now I don't need the painkillers anymore, she wrote. And that was just, wow. Because I don't have any more arthritis. It's all gone. And why? Because she followed that precise method of meditation. Become aware of your joints. Learn how to relax them just a tiny bit. Tiny bit, a tiny bit, a tiny bit, a tiny bit, a tiny bit. Incrementally. Took her a few months. That's not that bad. A few months of learning about her body. How to relax it, how to be kind, free of all that tension. And of course the next thing is, apply the same method to your mind. Relax your mind. A little bit of aware, and just it gets more and more peaceful, more and more relaxed, more and more free. That's called meditation. And you find, just even right here, right now, just by learning how to relax your body, you feel so much more free. So much less aches. So much less pain. And sometimes there is things which happen in your body. You feel it. And you can, as I say, nip it in the bud. Before it really gets a big tumor, it goes. Even this, one more nice little story. Although I only tell about the success stories. When it doesn't work, I don't mention this. But most of them actually do work. There was that young girl, 13 or 14, just very recently. 12, maybe? Didn't actually say that. Oh, it must be about 11, I think. She had, something wrong with her. Had a CT scan, and they found that, she had a deformed spine. It was just a genetic run in the family. And she showed me, on her iPhone, a picture of the spine, all sort of twisted. She looked fine, no pain at all, but she said if she doesn't do something about it, she'd get very, very sick when she gets, 13, 14. And she said the doctor, the physio, said she had to wear this really big brace over the top of her body. It was really painful. And just, quite limiting. She was a young girl, wanted to do sport and all sorts of stuff. Embarrassed her as well, going around school just looking like some sort of zombie, I don't know, because she couldn't move properly because of the big brace, trying to keep her spine still. And then, so I said, Ajahn Brahm, can you try and help, please, 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 please? And so I told her that just this method of meditation. And just, because you can't actually just feel it, even just visualize it, visualize your... And get some feedback. Visualize, first of all, your lower spine straightening up. And just, and it worked. She came and saw me with her mum. Her mum was always almost in tears. He said, well, look, she showed it to me just before and after. That only the lower spine, the top spine still needed some work. But the doctor said, well, straighten up, what the heck have you been doing? Which is weird. And that was, you know, for a young girl like that, you know, starting off her life, you know, that brace would have taken away her confidence. And, you know, she was obviously one of these people full of life, full of energy, you know, just wanting to live her life. And this was just like putting a top half in a prison of iron and metal. At least you can just free it a little bit down the bottom. It gives her hope that, you know, maybe just try the top part next. See if you can straighten that out. It does work. So you see now, these are actual x-rays. Ooh. So, one of the reasons I talk about this is to encourage you. This meditation is really important. Getting enlightened, yeah, that's be helpful. So, no, seeing limiters, yeah, that's nice. But being alive and free of pain, I mean, that is really important. So people will meditate because of that. Become enlightened. Well, become enlightened next lifetime. That's the trouble with Buddhism. We're always so cool to relax. Because you don't need to become enlightened in this lifetime. Come on, stop rushing around. Just, there's another lifetime afterwards. You get enlightened then. So, you know, so stop rushing. That's one of the problems. But this is, you know, you're feeling it right now. You're much more in tune with your body. So you're working with your body, you can really learn how to relax that body and feel the great health benefits. Yeah. Okay, so that's a bit of meditation instructions. Get rid of the five hindrances, or at least subdue them, then you can start to be really aware of your body. So that's Vinaya Lokaya Bija Dhamma Nasang, and then being aware of your body. The first Satipatthana. So that's what I talked about this morning. The first Satipatthana. Sadhu! 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 Oh, come on, monks are allowed to be a bit crazy, aren't we? And nuns as well. Yeah, nuns agree. Okay, we have interviews now. Please try and keep them to time, because otherwise I will turn into a pumpkin. Actually, I'm already a pumpkin. I'm going to turn into a cucumber.